Coming up on episode 76 of the Upful Life podcast. It all began
with a thought. That elementary grade curriculum and that project in general, and really a lot of what I'm working on right now, is trying to highlight the simultaneous differences and similarities that we have, right? The things that come from a specific place or a specific culture or a specific person, but contain within it something that is so universal that everybody can feel it and vibe with it and be inspired by it. It all began with a thought. I guess it was not only hip hop culture, but that time period, the 90s in general, and the travel culture that existed. There was so many different elements, disparate elements that were coming together, right? There was this juxtaposed quality to things where you're going to be with people on that trail, on that, like, you know, rainbow Grateful Dead travel trail, where you might have, you know, people in a van together, where this cat is obsessed with like the Beat Poets, and then this cat is obsessed with country music, and then this cat is obsessed with all the like 70s hippie shit, and then this cat only really knows about fish, you know. But those people are all there because the purpose of why they're there in the first place is the quest itself, right? So you have all this sharing of all this different information, and then you have kind of like the hybrids that come from that. And I feel like that's what GFE very much was, is this really weird hybrid of disparate elements of different cultures that came together just for this brief period. It all began with a thought. Yeah, I mean, if you were there, you know exactly what it was like. It was at times very tight and completely keyed in with the entire consciousness of the audience, you know, completely encapsulating a moment in time that was brief but beautiful. And at other times, it was completely sloppy and chaotic and falling apart and encapsulating a moment in time that was brief but beautiful.
I'm a bozo.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I thought you had it. You recognize it.
I like it that much.
Yes, indeedy. Welcome to the Upful Life podcast. I'm your host, B. Getz, and this is episode number 76, coming at you live and direct from the Vibe Junkie Studio in Oakland, California. 76 in the mix. So grateful you are tuning in.
The day was hot and the wine was refreshing.
Come my way for 40 days and for 40 insights. Sink into the stars of these Arabian nights. From Don Morocco's block to the Golan Heights, we're searching for a song to turn the wrong into right.
I am AVL, also known as Independent Arts and Music of Asheville, has been preserving and promoting the creative community in Asheville, North Carolina since 2012, gradually watching Asheville become one of the hottest music scenes in the country, supporting all those making noise in that city, and archiving the history in the making. With live stream installations in several Asheville area venues, IMAVL streams shows up to 6 nights a week and often several on any given night, which makes Asheville the first city in the world with its music scene aggregated into one channel. 3,500 concerts in the archive from national to local. There's plenty to explore. Based out of the world-class Echo Mountain Recording Studios, IMAVL also produces an original series called Echo Sessions, 6 seasons deep on PBS. All things on IMAVL are free to watch and a free service for the bands and artists at the venues that they are installed in. IMAVL is a nonprofit organization, so people can donate to their efforts and support the arts by heading to the website imavl.com or conveniently scanning a QR code on a recent show in the archive. IMAVL is passionate about the city they live in, Asheville, North Carolina, and its amazing musical community that they built in the Little Valley in the mountains. IMAVL.com. Don't stay home without it. I want to say thanks to my man Josh Blake and the whole IMAVL crew for 8 sponsored episodes on the Up for Life podcast. We are going to push pause now and have some other sponsors get involved and reconnect with IMAVL down the road. They're fam as fuck. I'm so grateful that they believed in the show, got behind it the way they did, and I hope all my listeners check out IMAVL.com. And yeah, very appropriate for this particular episode 76 of the Up for Life podcast. Now let's get into it.
I stand through an hourglass as the desert lasts through future, present, and past. And substance changes.
Indeedy. Greetings, dearly beloveds. Yes, I did take a month-long siesta, unplanned. However, in the tailwind of the past 2 episodes, I needed to circle the wagons and refocus and recharge a little bit. Roger Stevens from Blind Melon in 74 and Kruder and Dorfmeister in 75, now these all-time heroes are my real-life homies, had to pinch myself. So I took a little bit of a break. My mom was out here for 10 days. We spent a bunch of quality time together. I did the same with my wife. And just last week, we returned from another trip to Spirit of Suwannee Music Park for Resonate Suwannee, which was phenomenal. You can read about that on Live for Live Music. I tag-teamed the project with Dahlia, another music journalist. And you can check that out. Just dropped Live for Live Music and UpFullLife.com. I want to tell a brief story. After the last episode with K&D, you might have heard me say, I still think I'm going to come out to Denver. As a matter of fact, I did. My wife is on jam cruise, so flew myself out there for an extended weekend where I saw a ton of music and even more friends and kissed a bunch of babies. And it was amazing, but the highlight was meeting Peter Kruder and Richard Dorfmeister after their 2-hour set. Had an opportunity to spend a little bit of time with them, meet them, gift them a Lettuce vinyl record live in Amsterdam, and it got a rousing ovation by those who were in the room when I did so, and they were unfamiliar with Lettuce, both Peter and Richard, but they are familiar now, and hopefully next time Lettuce goes overseas to Europe and they do a tour when they hit Vienna, which they always do, maybe Peter and Richard will come check them out and we can close the circle even further. But thank you to everybody who sent me amazing notes and messages and emails and in person about the last 2 episodes. It really filled my cup up. It was life-affirming projects, and the reception and the embrace of the community and people around the world as far as K&D was concerned. It was really humbling, and I wanted to just take a moment and let y'all know that's why I took a break and how monumental that experience was for me, not just as a music journalist, but as a human being and a music fan and a music aficionado. It was everything. So thank you, Roger Stevens of Blind Melon, Peter Kruder, and Richard Dorfmeister. And now with that out of the way, some usual business here in the Upful update. I mentioned you can check out the Resonate Suwannee 2024 review on upfullife.com and Live for Live Music. I also did an article, a review on the Scarface show that we saw here in San Francisco. Now, Scarface of the Ghetto Boys, an iconic Southern rap pioneer, recently did a Tiny Desk for NPR, and it went viral. It was beautiful, heart-filling stuff, and he took that show on the road. Brad Scarface Jordan, the Behind the Desk Experience. So I took my mom and my wife, went out to an amazing dinner at Ofina in San Francisco. Shout out Chef Tim. And then we hit Regency for Scarface. So you can read all about that evening on Live for Live Music and UpFullLife.com. And if you're picking up what I'm putting down and you have the time and are so inclined, please rate and or review the Up Full Life podcast, preferably on Apple Podcasts, but really any podcast platform will do. It does a whole lot. Sending those algorithms in this direction, bringing us new ears, new listeners, new souls. And that, my friends, is a beautiful thing. So please rate and review the Up for Life podcast. You can also reach out, send me a note, send me a message, send me some suggestions, constructive criticism, reactions, reflections, by way of email. I love to hear from the people. Shoot it to b.getz at upfullife.com, b.getz at upfullife.com. And my heart is always full when I hear from listeners for this or that. It really means a lot. And everybody out there who does that, I see you. I feel you. And if you're feeling me and you want to support all things Up for Life, send me a couple of dollars for making you holla. You can do so on upfullife.com. There's a support button at the top menu. If you click that, it'll go right to the Venmo. Now, if you would prefer to send me some dough another way, we can work that out. Just shoot that email, b.getz@upfullife.com. But I am so grateful to everybody who listens, who shares it on social, who tells their friends, comes up to me at festivals and shows and shows mad love. And of course, a deep bow of gratitude to anybody who financially supports the Up for Life, because it's a grind out there and I'm still trying to figure out how I can keep doing this. So every dollar counts. Now let's get into episode 76. Yes, indeedy. Yes, indeedy. Another one we've been waiting on for a long time. Episode 76. It is my honor and privilege to welcome Cactus, Agent 23, Secret Agent 23 Skidoo, an educator, an artist, a father, a husband, a pioneer, founding member of Granola Funk Express, also known as GFE, also known as Galactic Federation of Earth Dwellers, representing Asheville, North Carolina. I first saw him playing at a fish festival in Maine in the 90s, just ran up on these dreads in a cypher with live instruments. They were like the hippie version of the Roots, but that does them a disservice. There's so much more than that. And then Cactus would then reinvent himself alongside his daughter Saki, aka MC Fireworks, and go on to win a Grammy. And now teaches kids through hip-hop, has the Secret Agency. I met him in Grass Valley, where he lived for almost a decade. Now he moved back to Asheville. Josh Blake from IMAVL was also a member of GFE. So it's fam as fuck. And I've been waiting to talk to Cactus for a long time. He's like Kevin Bacon. He's got a lot of connections. He's touched a lot of lives. He's been involved in a lot of things. And instead of going on for 10 minutes with his bio, this dude came to the pod ready to go and made my job mad easy and just had these long, thorough, detailed, insightful answers on lock, ready to go. And I like to think that I opened up some other doors that he doesn't talk about quite as often, but what he does give us is the full story arc. His own GFE, family, hip-hop, and so much more. I mean, I was just blown away by what this dude brought to the table. I'm just going to let him tell his story. No bio necessary. You're hearing a thought from GFE. It's an old school track from the early 2000s. Kind of encapsulates their sound, their vibe, their energy, their mission. But you're going to hear all about that and a whole lot more on episode 76 of the Up for Life podcast. Shout out to my guys, Kev Kavanaugh, Eric Carlson, Dom, Jersey Roots. I mean, those cats put me on game back in the day as far as GFE goes. And before there was like a late night post-Phish cottage industry, these dudes just loaded up the van and played bars after Phish shows. So I caught a lot of GFE over the years, and this was a lovely waltz down memory lane. So yeah, let's get into it. Episode 76 of the Up for Life podcast. I'm your host, B Getz. This is Cactus from Granola Funk Express. All right, all right. Well, once again, I have a very special guest that's a long time in the making. Been a fan of this dude for many, eras of my own life, geographies, different groups of friends, life experiences. Fact is, we've only really chatted a few times, met in person, you count on one hand, but his voice has been in my ear hole since I was a late teenager. And I'm here with a legendary cat, coming to me from Santa Barbara, but representing Asheville. And that's Cactus from GFE, Granola Funk Express, also 23 Skidoo. Welcome to the Up for Life podcast.
I appreciate you, man.
Yeah, man. Like I said, you know, I remember we talked just before you moved back from Grass Valley to Asheville, a mutual friend of ours, also an MC and beat maker, Jackson Whalen. I was doing a little Q&A with him. You were in the house. We connected. And since that time, that was at the infancy of this whole podcast. I knew there was this day had to happen. So I'm grateful for your time and energy and forthcoming reflections. But as I often do, I like to start in the here and now. I mentioned you're in Santa Barbara. You're in teacher mode. So tell me about what's going on there and how you're bringing 23 to the classroom.
Absolutely, man. Well, you know, for me, as we'll get into over the course of this podcast, finding hip hop, finding learning how to freestyle and then eventually write rhymes, that completely altered the course of my life. That completely evolved me as a person and is the core of my creativity and really introduced me to all the people I know in the world, right? From my friends to my wife, everything. So I understand how powerful that can be when that enters your life. And I've taken to teaching it over the course of the last decade, by which I mean I do residencies in schools from elementary up to junior high, up to high, and I even taught at a college the other day. And the concept behind the rhyme writing residencies, that evolved a lot in the past 3 years because, you know, I was basically coming in, teaching how to write rhymes in the way that I know. And a lot of that, even the residencies themselves, rely a lot on improvisation because I think that's kind of the best way to deal with kids. Like I have somewhat of a structure, but I really like to meet kids where they're at to see what they want to do that day to be able to let them evolve, you know? But anyway, I was teaching up in, you know, different spots in California, and then the University of Chico wrote a grant to bring us in to teach kids in Paradise, California, right? And I mean, for listeners who don't know, Paradise ended up in the headlines, you know, partially because the perfect irony of the name, Paradise basically burned down, and everybody who lives there knows people who died in that fire. Now, previous to that, Paradise was already struck with a lot of poverty, white supremacy, its own problems, opiates all over the place. And then the fire happened, and then the pandemic happened, right? So Chico wrote a grant, and the idea was rhyme writing as a response to trauma. And I mean, I've always known that music is a very healing thing, but I've never been in a position where I so explicitly was playing that role. You know, I'm not a therapist, you know, in any kind of formal way, not trained in anything like that. So that was an interesting way to approach things, but it worked so well that over the course of the next year, I kept coming back. I ended up teaching
every school, every grade level within that district. And what I started to do was evolve this idea of rhyme writing as rites of passage, right? Like, that's one thing that culturally we really lack in the United States, or at least those of us like myself, you know, white dudes separated from any kind of culture that I could name, is that we don't really have a lot of rites of passage, right? Like, for some of us, I think that's why we ended up doing things like getting out there and hitchhiking or train hopping or, you know, other kinds of spiritual psychic skydiving, is that we need our own way to prove ourselves to ourselves. And these kids that have been so utterly beat down by trauma, a lot of times they can't even find themselves. They can't even find their value, their worth, no hope, no ability to look forward to anything. And what I found was that the act of rhyme writing, the act of looking inside of yourself, finding something of value, and then bringing it out and sharing it with people, that's really similar to some rites of passage, right? So, okay, imagine it like this. Say you're, you know, someone about to become a man or a woman. You're separated from your community. You're put into a situation where you have to take a quest, maybe into dark woods, find something that you really are afraid of, then, you know, fight, defeat, overcome that fear. Then you're given a new name, and then you come back to your community and you share these powers that you've learned. You know, you share your new self with them. So with this rhyme writing residency over the course of 5 days, we do each of these things. Like, the dark woods is your imagination turning inward, going inside. You have to find something of value. You have to overcome your fear, which, I mean, part of that is getting up on stage, which is one of the scariest things in the world to people. But another part of that is just sitting with yourself, being able to look inside yourself and have the patience and the calm to actually be with yourself and try to find something of value, especially when you've been taught one way or the other to hate yourself. So they go inside, they find something of value. Then it gets to the point where they're about to get on stage, and we talk about the importance of a moniker, an MC name, you know, a stage persona, and how powerful that can be, right? One of the stories that I teach them at this point is, I say, you know, to these kids, I'm like, hey, do you guys know who Mel Blanc is? And they say no. And I'm like, yeah, you do, because Mel Blanc voiced all of the Warner Brothers cartoons, you know, or most of them, you know, Bugs Bunny, Tweety Bird, you know, you can just like run down the list. That's all Mel Blanc, right? And so Mel Blanc was this crazy cat running around, you know, he's got these characters inside of him, living inside of him. He's voicing all these personas. Then one day he wraps his car around a tree and he's in a coma. And he's in a coma for like 2-3 weeks, like, you know, way too long to be in a coma. Things are not looking good. And, you know, his family can't get him out of it. His friends can't get him out of it. The doctors can't get him out of it. And then this new neurosurgeon comes in, you know, kind of like young buck just starting out. And he says, hey, Mel, nothing. Hey, Mel, nothing. Hey, Bugs. And from the coma, Mel Blanc goes, what up, doc? And that brought him out, right? So why did that bring him out? Who knows? There's lots of theories. Some people say he's such the consummate performer that when cued, he came out. Now, that I'm sure that's part of it. But here's what I wonder. If he had said, hey, Tweety, what would have happened? Right? Because what's the character of Bugs Bunny? You can't defeat him. Nothing can defeat him. So maybe Mel had a personality living inside of him that was stronger than Mel, right? So maybe if these kids come up with a name for themselves, I tell them, you know, maybe you're scared of going on stage, but maybe, you know, MC, you know, these kids come up with names, man. MC Chicken Nugget, you know what I'm saying? Maybe Little Chicken Nugget's not afraid of going on stage. And then they can embody this thing, get on stage, and that's where they share this thing that they've learned, this power, back with the community again. And so the whole thing is completely transformative. I mean, I think I'm just pointing to things that exist in this experience for everybody, but by doing it explicitly, then kids get to have a container to put it in. Kids get to kind of like realize that they've been on a quest, that they've been on a rites of passage, and come out the other side feeling stronger for it. So yeah, I do that kind of thing, you know, depending on the school, depending on how long I get to spend with the kids. It's either as explicit as going through every of those steps and kind of naming them, or maybe, you know, sometimes it's just a 45-minute session where I get in there. I always start with, I tell every kid to write something, write a word on a piece of paper and hold it up. And then I put on a beat and then I freestyle and link all the words together into one rhyme. And I'm talking 40, 50, 60 words, you know what I mean? That's the skills that I have from way back in the day. Finally, I found a good place for them. But that gets their attention. And then we can get into the momentum of, you know, them finding their own words, you know. I just came up with a new thing that I tell them where I'm like, hey, today we're going to start by knocking on the door of your imagination. And remember, if you knock on a door and nobody answers, what do? You wait. You knock again. You wait. You don't just knock once and then if you don't hear anything, you leave or start talking to the guy next to you. It's like, no. You have to wait because your imagination sometimes is doing something and it has to, you know, take its time to come and answer the door. Anyway, that's what I'm up to.
Wow, dude, that was amazing. Just the way you took us through your program and the psyche of a young person or even a collegiate person. And yeah, my sister-in-law, when I met her, she was my brother-in-law. So I know a little bit about watching that journey and just, man, giving folks tools for self-expression where they could separate themselves from their maybe like immediate reality, which is so terrifying or unfamiliar. And step into this other character version of themselves and being liberated by that. And then you being a vessel and a facilitator, that's just so, it's beautiful. It's admirable. It's essential. It also took me back not long ago. I had the privilege of attending a seminar with Chuck D and DMC. And DMC was talking about as a child and hip hop. And he was like a comic book guy. And like the way he got into rapping was to assume the personas of his favorite comic book characters because he was a shy kid and he got teased a lot. And he wasn't like, you know, big badass DMC when he was like 8, 9, 10, but his brothers were around playing records, freestyling. And then he just sort of like emulating that. And he just made up superhero characters, or not make them up, but assumed their personas and their powers and put it into rhyme. And that was like the embryo for Darryl and DMC McDaniel. So that lineage or parallel is not lost on me. It's obviously an effective device that empowers a young mind and especially one that's maybe scared of, you know, their day-to-day existence. And man, people, those kids get forgotten. I mean, you remember in high school and middle school, the cool kids and not cool kids thing and isolation and, you know, sexuality confusion and like to give people like hip hop, self-expression, language, verbiage, at that crucial time in their journey is man, it's fucking A plus. So kudos, tip of the Kangol.
That's what's good.
And I know it's not, you're not coming out of left field with that because you have brought hip hop and the essence of rhyming and self-expression and character building. I mean, you won a Grammy for it. You created a whole lane or were among the pioneers to create this lane of like kids hip hop. And when you think of that, you might, you know, the average listener was like, think of some like Nickelodeon shit or something really silly. And while it's fun and funny and colorful, it's real hip hop.
Made up like the words to this. My imaginary friend says I'm the imaginary friend, which means I'm imaginary then.
If he's right,
and I'm really not sure that he's wrong.
So I might
be made up like the words to this song. I got a friend named Pickles. His favorite food is mustard popsicles. He got green hair and orange skin, and nobody has fun more than him. He's the sort of friend nobody can see, nobody but me. You're like,
what do you mean?
He's imaginary, invisible, but he's never scary. Nah, he's really cool.
Your daughter involved, and there a whole scene blossomed out of it that really peaked with you, you know, getting that Grammy. So can you take us through like your own conception and the evolution of 23 Skidoo and how that like father-daughter thing was, and also like watching it blossom and seeing other artists and other families and other geographies like doing the same thing and knowing you had like a role in seeding that whole thing?
Yeah, definitely, man. You know, I feel like I've been lucky in that I've been part of some really cool scenes as they happened, and sometimes as they began to happen, right? Like Asheville, North Carolina.
You know, we moved there when that place was basically boarded up downtown. I've been chased down Lexington Avenue by a bald Australian with a chainsaw for street performing on Lexington when most of it was boarded up. You know what I'm saying? You go down there now, it's like we're next to the Urban Outfitters, you know what I mean? But being part of that burgeoning scene was really cool. Being part of the traveling scene of the 90s, right? Hitchhike and Train Hop and all of that, going to, you know, Grateful Dead shows, Phish shows, Rainbow gatherings back in the day. That was, you know, I look back and I'm like, that's an incredible scene that I got to be part of. The same thing with this family music thing, right? So let's see. I was about 30. My daughter was about 5. And I'd been performing with GFE at that point for about a little over a decade. And it kind of all came together with, you know, GFE was always a very beautifully chaotic good organization. You know, we had two drummers at one point. We had, I think, six rappers at one point, plus other vocalists. Like, you know, it was just this big tribal organization with no real head. And it had this momentum. And I think that was because it was part of some of those scenes that I'm talking about. You know, we were representing aspects of those scenes and intersections of hip hop in those scenes. So it had this momentum. But at one point, somebody left, which was Cricket, the bass player. And for the first time in our history, we had this time where we just didn't quite know how to take a step forward. And that was because, I mean, a normal band at that point would just audition people. But with us, it had always been a family thing where people appeared when the time was right and got absorbed into the Borg that was GFE. And, you know, so we didn't really know how to move. Like, we literally experimented with all kinds of other options. Like, well, maybe we don't need a bass player. Maybe we could just have, you know, we could do synth bass. We could do that, you know. But I mean, it was pretty clear that we needed the bass player. Eventually, we auditioned. Dave Mack became part of the band. We kept going. But during that period of time, I realized that there was an instability to it. And that kind of freaked me out because I mean I had really dedicated my life to it, but you know that was the platform I was standing on. That was the thing that I was wishing for. It was all of it, and I kind of had a rude awakening of like, oh man, I got a 5-year-old daughter that depends on me. I need to be a little bit more in control of something, you know. And so I didn't quite know where to go next with that. I started doing some solo shows, and that was all right, but it just didn't quite have the traction that I wanted it to. Also, I mean, I was just developing that, so of course it didn't. And then at one point, I heard about this scene that was just kind of beginning to happen. I mean, family music has gone back, you know, a very long time, but there was a scene happening right around 2006, 2005, where a lot of people were creating independent, intelligent music for families, not for kids, but for families, that was sophisticated enough that the grown-ups involved could dig it. I mean, think Pixar, think Jim Henson. You know what I mean? Think the kids' literature that everybody is reading, the young adult novels and whatnot. There's always been this different kind of media that sort of straddles that line between the child who's growing up and the child that exists inside of all of us, right? Not like the dumbed down, sugared down stuff, but like the boiled down, powerful stuff, the stuff with the magic in it. And there was this new scene of music that was coming out doing that, where, you know, there's people doing it with punk rock, there's people doing it with bluegrass, pretty much every genre. There was a new wave band. They're not around anymore, but there was like a kids' new wave band that was cool, family new wave band. And I looked at it and I was like, wow, this is really interesting because everything that I've been doing with GFE and really my whole time as a rhymer, I've been interested in telling like weird psychedelic stories. I've been interested in my music having like a positive effect and, you know, believing in the idea of thinking positively and making that magic happen, you know, from the love that you put into the world, you know, social consciousness, these kinds of things. And so for me, the leap to do something for families was not that big of a leap. That was like a slight step to the left. And it seemed like something that maybe would make sense. And also, I mean, I'd been going on tour a lot. I mean, I remember when Saki, that's my daughter, when she was 2 weeks old, I jumped on a 2-week tour, you know, just because that's how it was back then. Like,
There's no way I'm going to stop the momentum of GFE just because I had a kid. And then when somebody else has a kid, they didn't either, you know? And so, and some of those kids ended up as babies on tour, on the tour bus with us. Like, that's just how it was. So, you know, there was also something to me that I really wanted to connect with my daughter and to sort of share the world that I loved with her. So I took the stories that I was telling her and the games that we were playing and whatnot and started making a hip hop album out of it, you know, records, MPC, chop it up, make the beats, start to put it down. And I don't know, it had this feeling to it. There was a clarity of focus. The parameters of the project were really clear. And that sort of just laser focused the whole thing. And then somewhere about halfway into it, she got into it as well. I like wrote her a little piece. Then she got on the mic and did it. And then we did a live show with like the first three or four songs. And she just jumped right on the mic, you know, perfectly on time. And so I continued to ghostwrite for her. And she had another like whole song on that album.
It's the family tree in the place to be.
Antoine's race to do is raising me.
And she studies in school most definitely.
And I know I'm the learning special MC. I've been rhyming cyphers, she's songs in diapers.
Between me and her,
I don't know who's tighter.
My style's kinda old school.
My style's kinda preschool.
We're known to rock and put smiles on the people.
I'm older, we'll go town to town.
The wheels on the tour bus go round and round.
On the take back seat when I sit in cars.
Do you get twinkle?
Of course I'm a little star.
And when we started doing shows with that, the traction was just instant. Like I knew I was onto something. It felt great. It felt great to have my kid on stage next to me. It felt great to have my wife up there dancing and singing as well. It was just like when you put everything that you love into the same basket together and it amplifies. I mean, sometimes putting it all into the same basket can be risky. And maybe even this time it was risky. It probably was. But truthfully for me, it amplified everything. And so I was pretty dedicated to doing that. I mean, I did GFE and that at the same time. But then this thing really picked up steam. And so for the next 7 years, I got to tour with my daughter next to me, playing like Lollapalooza, Austin City Limits, the Smithsonian. And then, you know, 10 years from that first album, we made an album that we won a Grammy for. So I got to walk her on stage at 16 years old. And, you know, they're passing the Grammy to me. I'm like, no, 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 you pass that to her, you know?
And the Grammy goes to Infinity Plus One, Secret Agent 23 Skidoo.
This is amazing. First off, thanks to everybody who voted for me and the Academy. I want to dedicate this win to my daughter right here. That's Saki, AKA MC Fireworks. 10 years ago, she was 5 years old. I taught her how to rap and we made an album. Here we are 10 years later.
So it's cool. It's like really an amazing trip to take, you know what I mean? And now my daughter just graduated college. She graduated with a political science degree. She's up there in Crested Butte. She's a ski instructor, a dance teacher, and a grant writer for a startup company that uses mushrooms to make human poop disintegrate. But yeah, it's incredible. And we continue on with it. You know, the teaching angle of this has been really interesting. I made an album in the middle of 2020 with Asheville Symphony. I was really trying to figure out some way to approach the conversation that was happening, how the cultural war that was happening in 2020, that conversation had so much friction in it, and it was so reductive. Right? The black and white idea in America is so reductive. I mean, obviously that's a conversation that's important and that we should all be having. But one thing I noticed about it in that moment was when you just bring it down to what's happening in the United States, you're cutting off such an important part of that conversation, which is its roots, you know, which is where did people come from to begin with? What culture are they coming from? What culture are they bringing to the United States? What's up with all that? So we created this album called The Beatbox Symphonies, where I found folk tales from around the world. And I focused especially on cultures that tend to get marginalized in the United States. And then I found pieces by Johann Sebastian Bach that I thought emotionally resembled the folk tales, then chopped up and rearranged the Bach melodies into hip hop joints, then reached out and found musicians from the culture of origin from each of the folk tale to play the, you know, the chopped Bach melodies on the native instruments and the native styles of wherever the culture was. So, for instance, we have, you know, a Japanese piece being played on a koto. We have a West African piece being played on a kora. And these are still the recognizable Bach melodies, but, you know, chopped into hip hop and then played on these instruments. Then we scored some symphonic pieces around those, turned them into hip hop songs. I rewrote the folk tales as raps, rapped those, and then collaborated with vocalists from each culture to sing the hooks, add some of their language into the pieces, etc.
There was a man in Japan, he lived near Kyoto. Back in the day before people had photos. What's even weirder, they'd never seen a mirror. They saw their face reflected in puddles, but nothing clearer. Then one day, he took a trip to the city where he wanted to get his wife a gift that was pretty. He saw a tent blowing in the breeze, below some trees, filled with strange treasures from overseas. He was so intrigued. The guy inside told him stories then, showed him the best prize in the whole emporium. Pulled out a mirror, the man was amazed. It looked like a window to a whole other place, but the
we then took that and expanded that out to a full elementary grade curriculum that talks about each of these cultures, has conversations with each of the creators, talking about, you know, what is the difference between United States and where they come from? How did they get attracted to hip hop? How do they get attracted to classical music? And it just creates all these beautiful connections, right? And I think that if we're trying to have that conversation about our differences, then we should start with what's beautiful about those differences. And we should start with, you know, how far back do these cultures go? What can we learn from it? Some of the stories that I'm dealing with on that album are more than 1,000 years old, right? And it's what I love about it is each thing, it shows how different the cultures are that we all come from. But then it also shows how universal a lot of this stuff is. Because, yeah, this story that is in 1001 Arabian Nights, this is from an area that at that time would have been called Persia. You know, now it would be a story that moves from, begins in Iraq, and then it goes to Egypt, Cairo, and then back to Iraq. The story here in 1001 Arabian Nights, it's called The Ruined Man Who Became Rich Again Through a Dream. This is also the same story that Paulo Coelho's The Alchemist is based on. So the idea is there's a dude who's completely broke. He lives in a shack. It's this rundown shack. He's a trash picker. You know, he's just walking around picking up garbage and everything. And he's broke. Every night he has a dream that he's rich. And every morning he wakes up and he's still broke. And it's torture for him. And so he asks the God of dreams, he says, please let this dream become true. Let me become rich. And so he goes to sleep that night. And then he has this dream. He has this dream of this temple in Cairo, Egypt. And he wakes up and he tells his wife, I have to go to Cairo. And she's like, what are you talking about? You've never been to Cairo. And he's like, I don't know. I have to go to Cairo. So he goes, and it's, you know, especially for somebody who's broke, that's a long trip. He has to basically do the whole thing on foot, walks all the way to Cairo, finally gets there, and the sun is setting, and he finds the temple, and he's like, well, now what? He has no idea what he's supposed to do next. So he says, well, I'll go to sleep, and maybe I'll have a dream, and maybe it'll tell me something. And so he goes to sleep. He has, you know, regular sleep. But while he's asleep, the temple gets robbed and the thieves come in. They take stuff. They leave. And then he wakes up right as the cops show up and the cops think it was him. So they take him in as a thief. And, you know, he's getting questioned. He's getting badgered. They're going to throw him in prison. And finally, the main cop is like, all right, what's going on? And he's like, fine, I'll tell you. And he tells him all about, you know, the dream that he had. And that's why he came to Cairo. And that's why he was at the temple. And it's not suspicious. It's just weird. And the cop starts berating him and says, oh, you idiot. Like, I have a dream every single night about this rundown shack in Iraq. And you think I go chasing that dream? In my dream, there's a huge treasure that's buried right behind the shack. But am I going to go look for that? No, I don't do that because chasing dreams is stupid. So don't do it. Now get out of here. And the guy's like, yep. And he runs back to his shack, goes behind it, digs up the treasure, and he's rich for the rest of his life and all his kids and, you know, for generations. That's, you know, a story that comes directly from that culture and it has elements that are from that culture. But like, that's such a universal idea, right? The idea that, you know, you go out looking for your fortune and then you end up coming back to where you started. And that's where the fortune was all along, but you never could have found it there unless you went out to seek it somewhere else first. You know, that's a beautiful idea. So, Anyway, yeah, that elementary grade curriculum and that project in general, and really a lot of what I'm working on right now is trying to highlight the simultaneous differences and similarities that we have, right? The things that come from a specific place or a specific culture or a specific person, but contain within it something that is so universal that everybody can feel it and vibe with it and be inspired by it.
Damn, homie. I mean, that's deep on so many tiers and levels. So thank you for, man, articulating that so eloquently and with context and emotion. So many things I didn't even have on my list about that answer. First, I just wanted to acknowledge the conceptual idea of cross-pollinating the musical instruments, languages, geographies is brilliant and so effective. And also like the message and the intention behind it, you know, wow. And it reminded me of in the book Dilla Time by Dan Charnas, which is like incredible, not just the story of Jay Dilla, but of just musicology, cultural anthropology. He also takes us on an intercontinental trip from Africa to like Vienna, Austria, with like rhythm and like the African drum at versus like the European version of like what is music, like notation and theory. And then with the slaves and the colonizers coming to the US and the sort of hierarchy of music intelligentsia, and then how like Jay Dilla with modern day technology took elements from Africa and like theoretical stuff from Europe and then completely broke it down and rebuilt it in the context of like an MPC or SP-1200. Like, and so he took us on that journey, and I just saw a parallel with you doing the same thing by selecting musicians and instruments native and indigenous to regions, and also these like canonical works of Bach that, you know, are held in this rarefied air for centuries, and then the baby that is hip hop that just celebrated its 50th year, and then you just getting in the lab with that, and then also making it an educational force that not only like teaches, but also like addresses this abhorrent disease that we are all living through, because obviously it's not working. The other shit, this reductive shit, this, you know, I'm in this tent, you're in this tent. Like I have all kinds of conflicting ideas about it. And I know where my heart lies, but when I see or hear about somebody taking such a intentional proactive step to say like, all right, we got to do something about it, do something differently. And you're also, you know, I'm sure you've, you know, worked up against some, you know, people with are sensitive and rightfully so, especially with our melanin free pigmentation. We're guests in hip hop, Black American music, et cetera. And I like to think humbly, we both carry ourselves in a way that we're welcome guests, but we're still guests. And so to like, yeah. The cultural appropriation and for you really need to earn the respect of the keepers of the flame per se, you know, for them to participate and bequeath koras and such, and these, you know, ancestral rhythms and melodies, like, and then for you to have the liberty to like reimagine them. Like, just like I said, there's so many layers to that. And then also just teaching the youth, you know, just like the Rasta say, like the youth, and you've dedicated your passion, your art form, your intellect, your humanity to the next generation. First with your daughter Saki, and you just explained the path that took her on. And then now exponentially, all the people you're teaching and all the music you're putting out there that people are then using as reference to teach or to learn. I mean, fuck yeah, dude. Yeah.
So I was working on that project in the middle of 2020. And then I was also working on this other project where I did an original book for Audible, right? It's an audio book. This is a complete breakdown of, you know, how to write rhymes, how to perform rhymes for young adults. So it really goes in. And I also wanted to frame it as not only that, but connecting people with the cultural understanding of what music and storytelling really is. And like what its power is, because United States, everything gets monetized. We're in a hyper-capitalist environment. So it just kind of gets put into this box as like, you know, sellable entertainment more than anything. And even if it has meaning and potency, then that gets monetized too, right?
So I wanted to highlight cultures that really put storytelling and songwriting into the very high esteem place that it should be, you know, that it is, regardless of whether people try to ignore it. It's still that in the United States too, even if we act like it's not. Anyway, so for that one, I focused on West African griot culture and indigenous Australian songline culture. And then also on a pretty interesting thing called flighting, which is Vikings basically rap battled each other. Then that passed on down to the Scottish and the English. Scottish and English wrote it down more. Vikings didn't really write stuff down so much. But there are amazing, you could go look at some Scottish flighting. I mean, I'm talking internal rhyme structures, complex syllables, and disses that are just some so hard and nasty, and then some so subtle and sharp that you're just like, oh my God. But for each of these, I reached out to folks from within each culture. And first we played kind of like a bed of music that I then explored, you know, told the story of this specific act, or sorry, specific aspect of these specific cultures, right? And then we took that bed of music, chopped it, flipped it into a hip hop joint. And I found representatives from each culture that were also MCs. And we kind of rapped about the connection between that and hip hop culture, right? Anyway, I could go down that rabbit hole. Oh, another great thing about that too, is I was thinking about the different cultures involved, and clearly one of them is hip hop culture. And so, you know, that's, as you say, a baby in terms of it only being 50 years old, which means that its originators are still alive. So that means that's not my story to tell. That's the originator story to tell. So I reached out to Grandmaster Caz, and he wrote and narrated the chapter on the hip hop history, the history and origination of hip hop. And then we got to do a couple songs together on that as well. So, you know, powerful stuff, man, powerful stuff. And especially during that period, 2020, 2021. And I was questioning a lot of things too. And I was questioning my place, like you say, as being a guest in hip hop culture, and how to do that authentically, and how to do that in a way that's like, you know, respectful and correct to the origins of it. And I'd always, you know, thought up to that point that it's like hip hop is specific and it's also universal. And the right way to appreciate instead of appropriate is to understand where it comes from and educate yourself as much as possible about the originators, and also direct people back to the originators, not act like you came up with something. You know what I mean? That's a big part of it. But what I really learned during that process is, what is culture, right? Culture is songs, recipes, stories, all that. But really, more than anything, culture is lineage. Culture is the passage of information, you know, down through the generations, right? So I think that part of how you respectfully interact with something like hip hop, which is a constantly evolving culture, is you not only connect to the history of it and help connect other people to the history of it, but you make sure that you go do something different with it to make it have, like, you know, a different future as well through the lens that you can give it. So therefore you become part of passing it down in a different direction to people who might not interact with it otherwise. And then you become part of its lineage. You know, that's how I feel anyway.
No, I totally see that. And also see how you carry and comport yourself, and how you don't center yourself, even though you are the cog in the wheel. You're asking for the voices and stories and contributions, and letting the people who have a sense of ownership do it. And in doing so, that selflessness and intention brings you into the lineage and legacy, because without you at the wheel, it doesn't happen. It's a vision that you have, and it took, you know, it takes the whole village. Man, and Caz, I mean, say no more, you know, doesn't get more OG than that.
Look past the garbage, over the trains, under the ruins, through the remains, around the crime and pollution, and tell me where I fit in. South Bronx, New York, that's where I dwell. To a lot of people, it's a living hell, full of frustration and poverty. But wait, that's not how it looks to me.
I'm so impressed and really just touched at the care and intention behind such a project, and it's evergreen, it's timeless. You know, it's not the type of thing that's going to be a flash in the pan. This can be curriculum and recreational listening for the rest of time, because it is literally by definition timeless. Man, I love that. And, you know, we'll be playing little snippets and samples of the different work you referenced in there. But I'm going to put a link to that whole record in the show notes for the listeners so they can really dive into that whole journey. And this is not new topography for you as an MC, because, I mean, GFE was, you know, nothing if not a conscious rap group, you know, at its core. Mm-hmm. And just to personalize it a little bit, I remember coming upon y'all, I want to say it was either Great Went or Lemon Wheel, you know? And so for those listening, you know, that's a fish festivals that took place in the late 90s in Maine, not just in Maine, but at the furthest most northeast tip of Maine, 16 hours from Philly, where I lived at the time. And it was like, you know, it was a different time for festivals, for fish, for the culture. It was in the not the immediate wake of Garcia's death, but shortly after. Now, me personally, I was like a kid from suburban Jersey who, you know, was lucky to go see the Dead at 14. So I caught, you know, 9 Dead shows, 1 Jerry Band show before he passed in 95, but only from age 14 to 17. Then I went to college in Vermont. I was already into fish a bit, got really into fish, started rolling with a group of kids. That version of me who loved hip hop, you know, I was always a hip hop cat, even though I didn't wear it outwardly in my cassette deck. You know, if it wasn't a Dead tape, it was the Beastie Boys, Pete Rock, CL Smooth, Tribe Called Quest, you know, you name it. Mm. I wouldn't say I was like ahead, like I became later, but there was a sizable amount of hip hop in my ears and the Roots. That version of me, you know, 1920 with that DNA is what walked up on the cipher at the Lemon Wheel or Went. And just like discovering the Beastie Boys and being like, wow, I could be a part of this. This is like, you know, a dozen years after that. I had a similar like lightning bolt strike. Wow. Because it's like a mess of dreadlocks, live instruments, circular cipher. The topics are relevant to like what I'm into: weed, the Dead, spirituality, good food.
Interstellar, Earthrella, Interstellar, check it out. Yo, yo, I swoop down in my X-Wing fighter, steal your lighter, spark your mind and rock the cipher. My style is tighter, the living conditions in Japan, and I shine so hard the whole audience catches its hand. And start jumping, bumping the funk is my function. Half the clubs I play explode from internal combustion, and I get taken in for arson, then pardoned by the governor, cause I gave her a fat ass slash bubbler, then puddled her, and shuttled her off to my home planet, and expanded her understanding of why me and my Martians landed on this blue-green globe to speak the musical code that brings an end to xenophobes and makes all hatred erode.
Blown away. And so that was the beginning of my becoming a fan of Granola Funk Express. And so I wasn't like my man Dom and Kev Kavanaugh, like those are the homies that like schooled me, kept me plugged into y'all. I wanted to shout them out anyway, you know, Eric Carlson, those are my GFE guys, right? But I always was tapped in. I always had a lot of admiration for the music, the familial vibe, and just the knowledge that was kicked. And I also remember being floored by the way you guys would mix in the imagery. Like you came to Metronome in Burlington, might have been like my second or third time seeing you, and there was a huge promo poster up in Metronome of the Grateful Dead Dead Set album cover, but it was like, you know, distorted to advertise the GFE show, you know? And I remember, man, I had that fucking cassette tape when I was, you know, 13, the Dead Set. And I remember being like, oh shit, they flipped Dead Set. I remember that show was fucking great. So I just wanted to kind of lay the groundwork, but as much, you know, it's kind of unfair to ask you to tell the GFE story alone, right? It's too many people's story to tell. So I want to preface it by saying, like, this is your version and not necessarily the definitive version. And I like to have Josh Blake on to talk about it. If, you know, Jerk or Adam Strange ever wanted to chime in, open invitation, you know, but you're here now. And I've been waiting to talk to you about this for a long time. And like I said, you connected a lot of dots for a lot of us. It was like, it was its own scene. Oh, another thing I want to bring up, it was like, it was very punk rock DIY in its like modus operandi. Like it was do it yourself. You know, like you could draw the lineage from like Rainbow stuff and train hopping to like how you moved as a band, as a crew, as a fam. And so just like you're pulling in all these disparate, diverse elements into your present day work. You were also doing that then. All of you were. So I just want to dive into the GFE origin story, the Rainbow Kitchen, the early days, and then like the sort of like decamp to Asheville, build a community, and then the afterlife, because you guys still get together every now and again and do shit. So take me through the journey, Cactus.
All right, cool. Yeah, first of all, you're definitely right. If you ask 10 different people from GFE what the story is, you're going to get 10 different stories. There's no doubt about that. And I hope you do, because I want to hear all of them. Yeah, and you know, I don't know, hearing you talk about that and trying to kind of put myself outside the perspective enough to look in and tell the story correctly, you know, one thing I really notice about that is like, I guess it was not only hip hop culture, but that time period, the 90s in general, and the travel culture that existed, there was so many different elements, disparate elements that were coming together, right? There was this juxtaposed quality to things where you're going to be with people on that trail, on that, like, you know, rainbow Grateful Dead travel trail, where you might have, you know, people in a van together where this cat is obsessed with like the beat poets, and then this cat is obsessed with country music, and then this cat is obsessed with all the like 70s hippie shit, and then this cat only really knows about fish, you know. But those people are all there because the purpose of why they're there in the first place is the quest itself, right? So you have all this sharing of all this different information, and then you have kind of like the hybrids that come from that. And I feel like that's what GFE very much was, is this really weird hybrid of disparate elements of different cultures that came together just for this brief period. Like when I look back at it, sometimes I'm like, man, GFE like only really makes sense in that period of time. Like, you know, where did it come from? Where was it going? It was just a representation of these different pathways that crossed that we all happen to be on. And like you said, like, you know, that's why we resonated with people, is because we were speaking to all of those things. You might have, even in the same song, because all of us came from different backgrounds and viewpoints, you know what I'm saying? You might have me jumping on there talking about positivity and manifestation and some kind of like, you know, psychic third eye situation. And then you have Tom jumping on there referencing, you know, beat poets or something like that, and just getting straight poetic. And then you have Jerk jumping on there doing some like grimy battle rap that is also calling out exactly what the CIA is up to right now. And like, those could literally be on the same song. Then with Josh Blake coming and singing like a sort of reggae hook on it. And then by the end, we're like doing some kind of jazz jam or something. And that made sense in that scene, right? Like, it was, I don't know, just all these different strains that happened to be braiding together at the same time. But yeah, to tell that story chronologically a little bit more, I mean, I can only tell my story, like you said, which is I grew up in a very conservative, small, shitty Indiana town. I grew up in the same town that Mike Pence is from, and they still love him, for the most part, you know? So me being me, I stuck out like a sore thumb for about as long as I can remember. My first memories of coming to consciousness was really kind of looking around and realizing that I looked really different from everybody around me, and they were treating me, you know, that way. That I was like never somebody who could necessarily blend. And I was always somebody who figured out pretty quickly that my differences were going to be the thing that people were going to notice. So I might as well use that to my advantage if I could. You know what I mean? I remember very young being like, oh man, I'm really, really, really standing out here. People are kind of looking at me strange. But at that, right at the same time, that's when Gremlins was out. And for whatever reason, I could draw a really damn good gremlin. So I was drawing gremlins and mogwais and shit. And people would be like, you know, people that weren't interested in me otherwise would come over and be like, oh, will you draw me a mogwai or a gremlin? And I'd go, yeah, for a quarter, you know, a little like third grade me or whatever. Man, I look back at that moment, I'm like, that's the birth of you as a professional artist right there. You're like, yeah, for a quarter. So anyway, kept going on with that. Ended up, you know, being in the skate culture of the time, which for people who understand what that meant in the 80s and 90s, like, that wasn't the popular kids who were skating. that's like more now that exists. But you know, back in the day, if you were a skater, you were probably like that punk, smelly, nasty kid that nobody would fuck.
Outcast, you know? For sure.
Yeah, Misfits, Outcasts, that whole crew. So that's where I was coming from. And along the way, found hip hop because, I mean, also like hip hop, punk rock, industrial, metal, that was all kind of like mixing in the same way at that point as well. And skate culture was at, you know, the crossroads of a lot of that stuff. So it wasn't really weird for somebody to be listening to punk rock and then also listening to early hip hop at the same time. That's where I got into that. And let's see, what would be the next step then? Yeah, you know what? Then I got into beat poetry and all that stuff, started reading a lot of Kerouac, and got obsessed with the idea of going on the road. I think that book must have done that to so many people. And it trips me out to think about that, because I could definitely draw a through line straight up to me reading On the Road and just kind of looking at the highway and being like, man, it's all right there. Like, I don't have to be in this shitty Indiana town. Like, I could be in New York or California. I could be any place. I could be where things are actually happening. So there was always this huge draw and this huge hunger to go do that. And it didn't take long before I did exactly that. Dropped out of high school, ran away from home as a teenager, you know, hit the road, started hitchhiking. And again, like, I was lucky enough that at that time, that was the situation that existed. You know, when you went off and started hitchhiking in that day, it's like you didn't even have to necessarily be going to a specific city because you were going into the vast moving city that was travel culture of the 90s. And it was a nomadic existence that just went place to place, and it would set up camp for a minute in places like Rainbow Gatherings, Grateful Dead shows, Fish shows, you know, the different great travel cities. I was telling somebody about that, you know, with street performance and whatnot in the 90s, that there were these specific cities that you would go to. I'm talking about like Eugene, Oregon, Boulder, Colorado, Burlington, Vermont, that if you went there at the right time, those streets would just be filled with travel kids. You know, if anything was happening nearby, like Rainbow Gatherings, Grateful Dead shows, even, you know, gem conventions, like random stuff like that, there would just be hundreds of kids that were hanging out.
Bread and Puppet.
Yeah. Best of all time there. Yeah. But so, you know, I escaped into that travel culture, and that's where I started meeting up with the other cats that became GFE. I met up with them at the Rainbow Kitchen that would be called Granola Funk Express. And, you know, that's where we got our name from. I mean, all respect due to that kitchen. Like, people know of Granola Funk Express as the band, but they also know of it as the kitchen, and the kitchen is the origin of the whole thing.
Only at a rainbow gathering. Hey yo, let me tell you what's happening. I was traveling with a pack of friends, three of us in a beat up bus, spray painted with pastel day glow patterns, and headed to the National Rainbow Gathering. Battling dust, pull the bus in the parking lot. Eight camps full of train trans sparking pot. We start to walk to the main trail, ready to roam. I heard a ohm and a stranger said, "Welcome home, brother." Nobody trying to act tough or be rude. It's all smiling faces, music and free food. Lots of trees too. The woods feel good. Never knew a forest could feel like a neighborhood. No rent, no cash, no clocks. Chop wood, carry water, haul rocks. Good vibes in the 13th tribe. Call me Sun Turtle. If you want me, you can find me at the drum circle.
Only at a rainbow gathering. Only at a rainbow gathering.
Not only in the sense of the name and a lot of the ethics behind it and a lot of the ideas behind it, but also in the sense that that's where a lot of us met each other, you know? Whether at the actual Rainbow Gatherings or in the traveling scenes that were part of that, Bread and Puppet being part of it, all of that. So, you know, a lot of us came together, and this specifically at the Rainbow Gatherings, for those who don't know, I'm sure most of your listeners probably know exactly what a Rainbow Gathering is, but for those who don't know what it is, this was originated by Vietnam vets that came back and felt completely dislodged and not at home in America anymore after their experience. And drawing on some of the ideas from Native culture in America, they created the idea of these rainbow gatherings that would be a place where people could gather in the woods peacefully, share food, share music, share everything, really,
like money is not really allowed in a rainbow gathering. So what that means is that when you're in there, you're not thinking about rent, you're not thinking about mortgage, you're not thinking about making enough money to get food. What you're thinking about is how can you share your energy in a way that is beneficial to the people around you? It's kind of like a little social experiment of a sort of moving city that is temporary and that you plug your energy in, however you're going to plug your energy in order to earn you know, your food for the day or your ability to be part of a group or whatever. And the way that a lot of us ended up finding that our energy was best suited in those places, beyond the obvious, you know, chop wood, carry water, that kind of thing, is performance. You know, we got into freestyling, we got into playing drums and freestyling at the same time. And yo, people in the woods with no electricity, no music, they loved that shit. They were, you know, it's very welcome, especially the fact that, like you said, we were becoming, you know, the mouthpiece for the concepts that were floating around that traveling scene. You know, me, I was inspired by Native Tongues, especially. I mean, you know, before that, I was listening to other hip hop, but something about Midnight Marauders, man.
My favorite jam back in the day was Eric B for President. Rude boy composer, step to me, you're over. Brothers wanna flex, you're not Mad Cobra.
Something about that and some of those De La albums that were popping at the same time.
Oh, 1-2, oh, 1-2.
Break it down. Break it down.
Oh, 1-2, oh, 1-2.
Break it down. Break it down.
Oh, 1-2, oh, 1-2.
I don't know. They were rapping about being a rapper in a way that gave me some kind of permission in my head to get involved. You know what I'm saying? Like to become an MC, to be able to experiment with that, to be able to experiment with freestyle and get into it. So, I mean, that was a lot of the spark for me. I mean, I could put it down to Q-Tip. I could put it down to KRS-One to a certain degree as well.
Whoop, whoop, that's the sound of the police.
For whatever reason, that era really cracked open my mind in the sense that I wanted to get involved. And when I did, I happened to be in that scenario, you know, in the rainbow gatherings and all that. So that was, you know, the concepts that I was talking about, that was the inspiration, or rather the combination of inspirations that I was drawing from. Same thing with all the other people that were rapping at the same time. And so then we got into the street performance era, which is that early on, we took what we were doing in the woods and we took it to these cities that I'm talking about, right? Boulder, Colorado, Burlington, Vermont, these places where you could go out on the street. You know, we would have sometimes up to 10 people. Sometimes we would just be beatboxing. Other times we'd be playing ashikos and djembes. Sometimes we would have like a tiny little trap kit, maybe a stand-up bass, and just take turns freestyling. And, you know, that's definitely where I cut my teeth on understanding how to put that stuff together, and especially on performance, right? Because if you're literally street performing to try to get your food for the day and people are walking by, then all you really have to do is start rapping about them literally. And they notice that they have now become part of the art and they stop and they're dumbfounded. And now, yeah, if you're part of the art and you leave without throwing down some money, now you're an asshole.
You'll get one.
Nobody listens to techno.
All right. Some lyrical flow just for a second. I reckon y'all want to hear us reckon. To the voices that beckon from beyond. Give me the microphone and let me drop the bomb. Just some lyrical poetry to open you up. That's what I want you to hear, because we're not corrupt. We some people that love peace and we love music and we love using it to boost shit to a higher level. Combining God and the devil with one line between is like the yin and the yang, and we all hang in the balance. The way to elevate is to learn to use your talents. And if you ain't got none, go check it out. Because of course you do. It's the source of you. It's inside of you. Like your heart, that's the creation of art. And everybody's got it. So if you can learn to freestyle on the topic, you can take all your stress and drop cake.
We all kind of cut our teeth on that. And we're continually traveling around. And then at one point we went to visit our friend Shaggy and Anastasia. Shaggy, who was the guitar player for GFE, and Anastasia, who is his wife, in Asheville. And this is when Asheville was, once again, you know, this is 96. So Asheville was mostly boarded up. There wasn't very much happening there. I mean, I'm sure to the people who were there, they knew about some real cool stuff happening, because it was already starting to, like, you know, starting to sizzle. But there was a couple of venues. There was like one coffee shop. It's very different from what you would see today, or what you would see, you know, right around 2000, which was a very golden age for that town. We come there we all hang out at Shaggy's house for a minute, and then we kind of have these conversations, and we realize that if we actually want to be a band, we're going to need things like instruments and songs, you know? And that's never going to happen if we just keep traveling around randomly meeting up in, you know, the woods or street corners and, you know, having these improvisational situations happen. So we decided to put our roots down there. And I mean, the funny thing is, and this really speaks to the power of the traveling scene that we were part of, you know, we didn't get started too quick with coming up with these songs necessarily. And when we did our first East Coast tour, because we played those travel cities, we sold out every show on our first East Coast tour, and we still only had three damn songs. We would play 2.5 hour long sets where we would do about 45 minutes of freestyle and then be like, oh, let's play one of our songs, you know, and then another 45 minutes of freestyle. I crack up on that so much because, you know, kids will come and talk to me now. I mean, like, you know, teenagers or whatever, 20-year-olds, and they're like, you know, what should I do to make my music happen? You know, I've been working on these tracks and I got the single that I'm putting. I'm like, do you perform? They're like, well, I mean, no, you know, I'm working in my bedroom. I'm like, dude, you don't even need songs to perform. Like, you know, you should get out there in front of people because that's the electricity that makes it happen, you know?
Just another street urchin out on the prowl. School faces walk around with a permanent scowl, acting foul. But I'm a different sort of human, set on keeping 1,000-petal lotus flowers blooming. So my brain expands as I travel lands, shaking hands, smoking out clans with contrabands. In city blocks, dropping deep talks on keys of Enoch, or high in treetops, vocalizing to the beatbox. Weather landlocked, or watching waves hit the beaches. We reaches, then releases shit to leave you speechless. Interstellar telekinesis, 7 cents, present tense. Return from the deepness too quick and catch the bends.
Right. So then that thing had its momentum. It felt great to be part of a scene in that sense. I mean, I always tell people too, like, bands that really can be magnetic and charismatic with the audience, they usually do it one of two ways. Either they look like complete space aliens from a different dimension, like P-Funk, or they look exactly like their audience, like the entire grunge movement, you know? And us, like, we looked so much like our audience that there were times where people from the audience wandered up on stage and started playing something and nobody noticed. You know what I mean? Like, there's a very thin line between us and the audience. There was almost no fourth wall at all. So that felt great. It was very cool. And you know, it had a great momentum going. We made a number of albums. We got to the point where we were touring in a tour bus, which was a big dream for all of us, which is super cool. Yeah, I mean, if you were there, you know exactly what it was like. It was at times very tight and completely keyed in with the entire consciousness of the audience, you know, completely encapsulating a moment in time that was brief but beautiful. And at other times, it was completely sloppy and chaotic and falling apart and encapsulating a moment in time that was brief but beautiful.
Well said, man. And I appreciate you taking us through the different eras and evolutions and embryos and all that. And yeah, man, like, it's funny because I think I was listening back to you kind of tell the tale. And I remember when whether it was like whatever show was happening, usually it was like Fish, you guys were among the pioneers to sort of piggyback and give us something to do after midnight for a few hours. And that's probably why I racked up so many shows, to be honest. It was always where my friends were headed, where we were headed. I was either locked in to the show, or I might have been talking to a female or meeting up with an old friend. You guys had your own little scene, sort of like a tributary to the larger scene, but completely independent of it. Also, like, you didn't need that, and certainly wasn't a part of your you know, it wasn't required to follow any band, Fish or otherwise, but you did make a lot of fans, including myself, by showing up and spreading your wings in that environment. And like you said, when you see people like yourselves, it was like the Beasties. It was like, wow, these are fucking hippie dudes and gals, love the dead, conscious, and, you know, look like me. And like, you know what I mean? And it just felt right on time. When we talk about the music itself, like, I don't want to be like play favorites or this or that, but at the end of the day, man, self-fulfilling prophecy is what I listen to the most, without question.
Thanks.
And that's no slight. Thanks. I always check out, even to this day, like Tom's new thing, which sounds nothing like hip hop. I'm checking that out. And of course, everything Josh Blake does. And, you know, every now and again, I'll see something from Jerk that'll come through, and he's still, you know, hard as hell, same as it ever was. So, you know, but when I think about like the music that I held on to outside of the experiences and the energy and the messages, which are in my bloodstream, all the energetic stuff, but musically, Self-Fulfilling Prophecy, which I, it's like a Wu-Tang thing. It's really like a GFE record, just with your name on it.
State and learning how to create my fate. I wasn't raised by the street, I was raised by the highway. My tribe migrates through tall trees, small towns, and skyscrapers. Psychedelic mind state, dropout, traveler, freestyle babbler, thrill seeker, mystery unraveler. The day I got my license, I started driving towards the horizon, learning the fine arts of panhandling and dumpster diving, writing rhymes and freestyling on street corners for change. Got paid to play every day, the whole world is my stage. People used to look at me strange like,
oh, poor kid, he's homeless.
Shit, I got no rent or bills, being on the road is a bonus. Why you not 9 to 5 and I'm smoking roaches and honing the skill that I know is ill, then I go and chill. That's how life is supposed to feel.
That's what I was going to say. That's like, that one more than any of my albums as Agent 23 is, I mean, that's a really broad album with 21 songs on it. I'm sure every member of GFE is on it. There's also other people from the scene at that time that are on it. So yeah, that's like very much a window into a period of time as much as anything. I've done other albums that had way, way less people on it that were produced by the same people throughout or whatever. That, I mean, I think there's like 10 different producers even on that, including myself for beats. And then there's like, you know, at least that many vocalists plus musicians. So yeah, that was definitely as a snapshot.
Saki Freestyle. That's early Saki. Early.
Yeah. Yeah. That's Breeze Ever Flowing. That is me coming out to the first show after my daughter being born and going up to Breeze Ever Flowing and telling him the story that he's got this song called Saki, right? And I mean, it's only really called that because it samples this Chinese music, but it's a really fucking dope beat. And I told him that, and I was like, yeah, man, I just want to let you know that after Saki was born, I made sure that the first song that she heard was Saki, you know, to like just kind of get that spirit in her like that. And he's like, oh, word. He's like, you want to get up and freestyle about it? I was like, yes, I do. You know, so I got up, and it was one of those moments when it was just perfect. Like, he did a verse, passed it to me. I did a verse. Then we started doing, you know, 4/4s back and forth, and everything is just completely cracking. And get off stage, and it's one of those things where it's like, you know, in my experience, the best freestyles are never recorded. You know, it's like there are moments that happen, and then like they just get given to the universe, like a Buddhist sand mandala or whatever gets swept away. A lot of times the best improvisational moments happen in that way too, like, you know, equipment will just malfunction or something. But in this case, it was the opposite, where I thought it wasn't recorded, and then about 6 months later, as I was, you know, wrapping up that album, Jerk's girlfriend at the time came and was just like, hey, put some headphones on me, press play, and it's a perfect recording of that freestyle. And I was just like, oh my God, are you kidding me, man? So of course that went on the album, you know.
Cactus, I need Cactus to come to the stage real quick, because we got to build on something. We was just having this conversation, and it was so real that I want to share it with y'all. The way we do MC Communicators. Yeah. Static, throw on the beat that sparked this whole conversation.
This is my shit right here. This is my shit. Yeah, right?
Yo, I was looking for something. I ain't know what I needed, perhaps this. Time to come to Asheville and run into Cactus. Told me this story about his little girl. I have a girl too, and in my world she's a pearl beyond value. I stood there like a statue that absorbed the information. He started lacing me with different descriptions of a time and place when his daughter was formed and born. He brought it to the stereo to help her get along.
And then we at the very end of that, we recorded Saki when she was like, you know, a couple months old, and you get to hear that voice.
At least your child came right now to save the earth, and you got the verse to teach your whole damn mind. So even if she's growing up with pot, she'll have hip hop to rock the spot.
I love it, man. I mean, I tell you what, that's the smartest thing anyone can do is to record as much as possible of these moments that we get to live through, because, you know, they seem infinite while you're in them. And then all of a sudden you're onto a new infinite moment. And when you get to look back and hear those things, see those things, it's incredible.
And I really, you know, I just love that record. And I love, again, the breath and the sort of, it just, the production and all the contributors. I just wanted to show that a little dap. You mentioned Breeze. I kind of, at the end of the thing here, is like, I have a list of folks, you know, kind of just by like the name game. I just want to drop a few folks from the journey, and you can just say, you know, you don't have to go too deep, but just to spread the love around a little bit. We'll keep it in the fam first. You know, FMJ.
I have a jerk, man. He was always the most anachronistic member of our crew, because, you know, whereas we all were coming from at least a hippie friendly mind state, you know, he's Dirty Jersey all the way. And he came in, and I mean, it was so funny, honestly, to see him in some of those situations. But the beauty of that, I love, especially when I listen to the old rhymes from that period, is that when he's talking about something like the concept of manifestation, or when he's talking about, you know, the positivity of a tribe of people operating as one, he's talking about that through the lens of somebody who could definitely be considered cynical. So the light, the power of the concept is held together by the walls of his potential cynicism. And something about that makes that concept so much more believable. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's been rigorously tested by his own cynical mind. And if he can be positive through that, then you know that you're onto something with this shit.
It was a party to remember, so forever in my brain is burned. The date for sure was April 3rd. As I entered, you spun records and the tables turned. Played it back for a while, didn't say a word. But as I cracked my OE, you approached me slowly and told me that a couple of dudes busted a move. Started up a cipher over in the other room. You said that I should drop a little something or two. Cracked a smile and told you that I got nothing to prove.
I don't know. I go back and listen to those, and I'm just like, man, there's just something about that, like a cat that comes from Jersey who is experiencing this scene almost like an anthropologist or something like that, because he's from so far out of it, who's kind of adopting the lifestyle and kind of like he's gone native now and he's speaking the language, but you can still hear that he's speaking it with a Jersey accent. It's fantastic.
Oh, man, he's fucking nailed that. But of course you did. You got like 3+ decades with him. But yeah, man, that's perfect. All right. Pass the mic to Tom. Adam Strange.
Adam Strange, man. I mean, you know, I don't like to play favorites either, but he's my favorite rapper in the crew.
Open minds, big rhymes that make people free. Make money, make family, and smoke ample trees. It's the G. What's F? What's motherfucking E? We done played every state, ate off the best menus. Get party people to overfill the venues. Cause come on, what you got better to do than get drunk and shake your ass while my crew spit truth? I like telling straight folks to take off their pants. Fuck it all, I'm addicted to changing my plan. Circumstance is to summon the bitch. Clap your hands and feel the bass that's bigger than breast implants. On a strip, I got a bong pack with Kron. It's GFE, old school, still man is strong. Still take a piss on the White House lawn. Flick off the president, then write him a song.
I don't know, man. Nothing he does seems forced. Everything that he does seems like he's just kind of like catching some kind of universal solar wind and riding it. That's true of his production, that's true of his writing, that's true of his performance, and that's especially true of his recording. You know, there's aspects to the way that he records, there's a fluidity to it that I'm still trying to get to. And I mean, that's his mind too. His mind moves that quickly. And another thing too, and you know, this is a throwback all the way to the beginning of this interview, but when you were talking about some of the cultural aspects and you said you had, how did you phrase it? Basically opposing ideas about the same thing. And that was confusing. And you were trying to figure it out. What I love about Tom is that he has opposing ideas about everything and has no problem with that. And I honestly think that that's kind of the, that's an indication of genius. You know what I mean? I mean, genius is a word that gets thrown around so much that maybe it's pointless, but I'll say that like, when I feel like I'm evolving at the highest level, it's the moments when I can hold two opposing ideas in my mind simultaneously without that being a problem. And Tom, both artistically and philosophically, is that 100% of the day.
Man, another grand slam. I honestly believe that that is what we seek to achieve with critical thinking in its core essence is to be able to comfortably or at least like tolerably hold space for conflicting ideas and stay true to oneself. And then the culture war, it's essential. And I think it's man, fucking nice. Shout out Adam Strange, Tom. All right. My dude, Josh Blake. Okay, Josh Blake's been on the pod. IMAVL has sponsored the pod. And Josh kind of pulled me back in. I think it's why we're even having this conversation, despite us connecting in GV, is way, I don't know, fucking decade ago, Fish Tahoe. I'm kind of just like wandering around pre-show solo. And he just called to me out of the crowd. He remembered me from the GFE days, just as like a tall dude, a little head above the crowd, familiar face, social media, whatever. And he's like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm walking all the way back to my girl's car because I left my tobacco in there. I got to roll some spliffs. And boom, pouch of American Spirit out the pocket. Dude, save that shit. And then like we just dapped it up, connected. And dude, he's nothing short of a super homie to me now. And, you know, I got mad love for him. He's coming back on the pod. But yeah, talk about Josh Blake.
Well, I mean, you just said it in that story right there. Like he's one of the most kindest, most giving people that I've ever met. And he's that for Asheville. He's that for GFE. He's that for everybody in his life. He's so generous, you know, musically and with his energy. It's impressive. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I don't know. You know how like back in the day you'd hear Obama speak and you'd be humbled? Like you might not even necessarily 100% agree with his policies. You might be like, I don't know. But like you might come into that conversation kind of like mad or agitated. But then all of a sudden Obama speaks and afterwards you're like humbled and a little bit inspired. Like that's kind of what it's like hanging out with Josh Blake. What I mean by that is like I'm just constantly impressed by his frequency. You know, I really think that he is very good at having his heart at the center of all his moves, at the center of all his conversations, you know, while also being there with a quick joke and cutting on you and all of that stuff. I mean, it's not like he doesn't have that part to him, but like, yeah, I mean, that's a cat that I just kind of look to and watch the way that he moves with community, watch the way that he moves with people and music and everything like that. And I'm impressed by it and I'm inspired by it and I'm trying to learn from it at all times. You know, it's like, I think that he took the thing that he figured out on stage where improvisation is a thing of give and take. And when you know how to do that correctly, that it amplifies to the point that it's greater than the sum of the parts, you know, and he has applied that to every aspect of his life. And I think, you know, GFE's better for it. Asheville's better for it, all that stuff. So yeah, the fact that he pulled out the American Spirit and gave it to you right away, you know, shirt off his back type of shit, that's him.
Yeah, totally. And the, just the fact that he was just like seeing me, like sense this sort of like distress that I was on this mission, just wanted to help and then was able to help immediately. And then that enabled us to just chop it up for a while, catch up, realize how connected we were. And like from that embryo of like reconnection, a friendship has really blossomed. And I watch how he moves in his community. And as a father and a partner, husband, business owner, nonprofit, just, you know, we're pouring enough kerosene on you, Josh, but we love you. And
Exactly. It's hard to do when you talk about it sincerely, right. You know? I mean, you know what? I think I just stumbled off the right word there. Sincere, you know? When he speaks positive stuff online or whatever, like, that's not strategic, you know? That's not an image that he is trying to create. That's literally the frequency that he's on is sincerity. And it's refreshing because, you know, the older you get, the more jaded people get. And, you know, when you have old homies that you've known for three decades or whatever, and they still are able to shine with that kind of sincere positivity, it's a really good thing to have around.
Cosine. And yeah, one more in the GFE fam. And I don't want to be, you know, F the patriarchy. So we got to talk Jenny Junk. You know, I always felt like she was a secret weapon. She just brought something cool to the sitch and was hilarious and didn't give any fucks.
The story gets boring if attached to the facts. If you go exploring, you may find the right track to get back to where you started and take a different path. Where you going and where did you come from? Travel lightly, trust your intuition. Never fight the urge, just to have fun.
talk about Jenny Junk.
All right, I'll tell a story that I love telling about Jenny Junk. When you say she doesn't give any fucks, it's like, yes. And the people who don't know, she is this, relatively short, but her energy is so big that nobody would think that, Greek woman of such power and mischievousness that it's fucking stunning. So here's the story. So we're sitting there at GFE practice at one point, right? And, you know, back in the day before any of us had any idea about business, we decided that it'd be a good idea to start an LLC. You know, we didn't know why. We just thought that's what people did, you know? And so we're sitting there and the phone rings. And this is long ago enough that, like, we're talking about, you know, the cordless phone from the wall rings. So she grabs the phone and we just hear, like, you know, we just hear her side of it. But I'll just tell both sides of it because it's hilarious when she actually explained what happened. And this is her character through and through. So she calls, she answers the phone, hello. And they're like, hello, this is the IRS. Is this the owner of Granola Funk Express LLC? And she's smoking a cigarette, you know what I mean? Smoking a Rolly American Spirit. She's like, yeah. And they're like, okay, well, you owe us $10,000. Because, you know, here's the thing. You get an LLC, there are certain things you have to keep up with every year. You have to, you know, pay certain, costs and things. And if you don't, then they start accruing interest and they start building. And all of a sudden you have the IRS calling you and saying that you owe them 10 grand, you know? So they say, you owe us 10 grand. She takes a drag of her smoke. She goes, we'll give you 3. And they're like, miss, I don't think you understand. This is the IRS. You owe us $10,000. She goes, well, it's 3 or it's nothing. And the IRS says, okay, we'll take it.
Fuck yeah.
Like, yo, what?
Who gets away with that, right?
That story is so crazy to me that when I remembered it, like, a couple of years ago, I actually called her up and I was like, let me break this story down and you tell me if this is true, because this seems so crazy that my mind must have exaggerated it. And she's like, nope, yeah, that's spot on. That's exactly what happened. But yeah, so she is the most badass chick that I've probably ever met. And beyond that, underneath that, not even underneath that hard exterior, because there is no hard exterior, being a badass doesn't necessarily require armor. In fact, if you're badass enough, you don't even need it. And that's her, because her heart is also massively huge. Right now, she's a therapist helping children who go through the most, you know, heinous traumas that you can think of. And the way that she does that is that she gets down on their level and she finds a place that's safe enough for them to open up and to be able to tell the things that they can't tell to most people, or to be able to act the ways that they feel like they can't act around people. And she helps heal these kids just through her acceptance and openness to allow them to be how they're going to be. That would almost seem like ideas at odds with each other, to be like so strong and badass, but to be so vulnerable and open to be able to create that. But even as I say it, those are two aspects of the same thing, aren't they? You know, true strength is when you don't have to force it. True strength is when you can sit back and let things happen and, you know, be strong enough to, like, hold space for them. And that's something that I think she's always had, but I've really enjoyed watching that bloom over the decades I've got to know her too.
Oh man, that's not where I expect you to go with it. That's a beautiful reflection juxtaposed to the hilarious, like, zero fucks given to the IRS, man. It's just, it's like, you know, 2 wings, 1 bird. So shout out Jenny Junk, and keep on doing that important work. And I'm just going to take a couple outside the fam before we wrap up. 2 people that were really pivotal to me in different ways. Both had connected with you as well. Listeners to my show will know a whole lot about Eric Krasno. He's been on this pod twice. I was his guest host on his pod a number of times. And Soul Live and Lettuce are, like, you know, on the rarefied air tier. And even his solo work to this day. So shout out Kras. And several years ago, he just offhand, I might have even brought up that I had talked with you at that Jackson Whalen event. I don't know. But around that time, he's like, oh, yeah, me and Cactus, we go way back. Yeah, I did tons of shit with them and Breeze. It's like, word? And then, yeah, he slipped me a couple things.
Time to vocalize, shifting to overdrive, spit like an organized hit, hard until the hip hop off and burn down the jam like the roster man hot sauce. Rock hard, brick residential, regrets never get into to get the presidential. True school skills and fundamentals, feel it come within whenever building from the pencil.
Tell me about collabing with Eric Krazo, if only because my audience will fucking love it.
Yeah, sure, man. Kraz's been brilliant since I ever known him, you know? I mean, that's a connection that comes more through Josh Blake, honestly, because that's that whole Massachusetts thing. But I think the first time that I really caught wind to him was they came and opened up for us at Butterfield Dorm in Amherst, right? That's nuts, right? Man, the people that have opened up for GFE, I swear. Sector 9's opened up for us. Listen, which is Derek, who is now Pretty Lights, opened up for us, you know, so we got to see a lot of these people go from their infancy to what they are now. But Kraz always like, man, first of all, that dude is a workhorse. Like he's the type of cat that especially back then would just be going from gig to gig to gig. And I didn't get the sense that it was something that was like, you know, strategic for his career or anything. I think he's just addicted to that space you get in when you're on stage, just like on the edge of the illest groove, the tastiest lick, just kind of like out there hanging over the cliff trying to find that thing. Like it seems like back then that's always what he was about. And I mean, you can hear it in the music till today, right? Like they find just the most intricately fucking funky pockets, man. And that was always true. I mean, they opened up for us, like I said, back in the day. That was amazing. That's one of those situations where you don't even know who you're looking at. And then all of a sudden something happens and just everything else in the room kind of stops and everybody's staring and like, what the fuck was that? You know, he makes those moments happen. And he did back then too. We've done some recordings together as well. Super kind-hearted guy. Again, a workhorse, great with production. He can do just as well making beats as he can with like playing in the moment. And I got to do some stuff with Breeze on that for sure. Definitely some, you know, legendary freestyles with Breeze over him playing and, you know, whoever the drummer of the day was. Got a couple of beats from him that are on the Monkey Wrench album, the Agent 23 Monkey Wrench album. He features on that. Matter of fact, I think I got one of the first times he actually was singing. He sent a track and he has like a little bit of him singing the hook on it. And I was like, oh, what's this? He's like, oh, you know, I'm just trying things out, just kind of starting some new stuff. So it's me and Adam Strange did a track called Shooting Star. This guy Kraz not only playing on it, but singing the hook.
Oh man, love that. I'm gonna drop that in for sure. Yeah, Kraz has been a big force in my life musically, professionally, and I love how many, like the tentacles, all the different musics, careers, lives. He's also a great connector. He's a great facilitator. He brings a lot of people together, and then they go off and do dope shit, and he put them together. So shout out Kraz. And last one is in my neck of the woods as a writer. When I was just starting to do this shit with Jam Bass 99, 2000, I used to see this cat writing on other sites. He eventually came to Jam Bass, eventually was editor-in-chief for Jam Bass, and is a sensei to me as a music journalist, and also, in my opinion, wrote the definitive article about Granola Funk Express, and that's none other than the great Dennis Cook, our guy down in Santa Cruz. So he's in quasi-music journalism retirement, but he still lives, breathes, eats, sleeps music and chimes in on my stuff all the time and occasionally picks up the pen. But tell me about your recollections of connecting with him and then what it was like to like read about yourselves in such poetic, historical musicology. I mean, that article of Dennis kind of plugging into the GFE thing and then just talking about it. I mean, it's next level musical journalism and only could have been done by him.
Yeah, man. I mean, he's Gonzo, right? Like, by which I mean, not only that he's like, you know, as weird as we are, but I mean, Gonzo in the sense that like he jumps directly into the story and reports from the field, even if the field is a moving bus. And that's what was amazing about that is like when he wanted to, I mean, I think he first saw us in Berkeley playing and got the vibe, but then like when he really wanted to get into it, he just jumped on the tour bus. And so, you know, we were hanging out with him playing poker in the middle of the night, talking shit. He got really, you know, he simmered himself in the broth of the entire experience of what being on GFE tour was. And yeah, as a writer, I think like he's got that same feel of like, I don't know, that like wild 60s, 70s, like he feels like somewhere between Hunter S. Thompson and Tom Robbins, you know, like so much flavor that he pours on everything with his words. I can't think of any other article that has ever been done about us that had anything like that much flavor. You're completely right about that. I'm sure that you're much deeper on his journalism than I am, but it seems to me that what I love about him is like, he's not a critic, right? He's in love with the thing that he's talking about. His enthusiasm about what he's talking is the main thing. So when you read it, you get that dose of inspiration. And it does come through that poetry and that like weird, wild, multifaceted manic energy that he puts into it. But like, it's not something where it's kind of like reserved and standoffish and he's kind of giving you the pros and cons of something. It's like something where he's fallen deeply in love and he wants to tell you about it. And he's going to tell you about it with this like huge blast of energy and all these wild descriptions and, you know, so many damn adjectives, you know, linked together like they're hanging from a Christmas tree or something.
Dennis, he, you know, there was no real roadmap for like internet journalism in the beginning. We were just kind of figuring it out as we go, not unlike GFE.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'd read magazines for years and liner notes. And then much like you'd listen to rap music and instrumental music too. And then all of a sudden there was just like a shift in the paradigm and everything went online and it was like the wild, wild west, you know, pre-social media when it was like message boards and blogs and articles and I just looked up to Dennis, still do, and his craft and his dedication and like you said, his ability to just immerse himself in the bosom of whatever it is and then report with like a kaleidoscopic arsenal of vocabulary and emotion.
Well said.
Second to none. So yeah, his article about y'all is among my faves in his canon, you know. So just that's why I wanted to ask. And you've been really generous with your time. Feel like, you know, this is the type of thing we could pick up and do in another year or two when you got a bunch of other cool shit happening. Sure. But I've been grateful for the opportunity to plug into GFE, to plug into 23 Skidoo, to just hear about your efforts to better the world is really what it is. Is from the Rainbow Kitchen to the teaching this morning in Santa Barbara, like your art and your essence and what you're contributing is wholly towards the betterment of everything. And man, we love you for it. So I want to ask you to let us know if there's anything we should look out for on the immediate future on any level, or just where people can keep up with all things 23 Cactus.
How can I say this? All right. So first of all, what I'm really into right now, a step that I'm trying to take, is all about storytelling, right? So one thing I can't quite say yet, but I'm just going to say, keep your ears out. There's a podcast that's going to be dropping that has to do with storytelling through a hip hop lens. And it's coming in a couple of months. And I can't say any more than that. But keep your ears out for it because it is dope. And I can't wait for the world to hear it.
Real quick editor's note here. Cactus has now announced this project since we spoke a couple months back. I'm going to read from his post. My tongue is untied. The project I've been working on for the last year and a half has just dropped. It's announcements time.
Once Upon a Beat is a podcast that takes well-known fables and fairy tales and then remixes them into 20-minute hip-hop musicals. The first season is out now for those with a Wondery Plus account and will be available to everywhere on May 1.
And we're going to be doing a special show where I take a bunch of the storytelling songs that I've created, whether that's me retelling Aesop's Fables or some of these beatbox symphonies where we retell folk tales or just stories that I've completely created up off the top of my head. We're going to be performing those along with Street Creature Puppet Collective, who are inspired by Bread and Puppet and also Paper Hand Puppets from Durham to create, you know, huge, sometimes 10-foot tall puppets of dragons and whales and moths and things like that. So they're going to be performing center stage while we're kind of to the side rapping the songs. We're going to try this as a new experiment because it's definitely something I see going forward, is that if I can get multimedia with it, whether that means, you know, something like what this podcast is going to be, whether that means movies, TV, or whether that means performance along with animation or puppetry or whatever it is, that it just adds more dimension to that same type of storytelling that I've been doing forever. So that's it, man. I'm just like, I'm into telling like these timeless universal stories and using hip hop as a medium to do it. I feel like that's definitely one of my places to sit in the universe and do some good, like you're saying.
But in case people in other regions outside of Asheville have like the grant money and the wherewithal to bring that out there, I mean, I think that's the type of thing that has legs, and I want to be able to facilitate, support that, amplify that, platform it, because, you know, we got a lot of listeners out there that are equally dedicated to enriching the future, both generations and atmosphere, environment, culture, community. And man, you're doing it and you're leading by example. And man, we're all better for it. So I want to say thanks and deep bow of gratitude for the rap session, for the music, for the energy, for your intention, leadership, and just moving through life with tons of swag.
Appreciate you, man. Appreciate you. And you know what? Congratulations on 76 episodes, man.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate you.
Especially on that last one. I know what that meant to you.
Yeah. I'm about to fly out there in 2 days and meet them in Denver. Man. And it's a dream come true. So I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, man.
Somewhere in a city slash desert, a madman slash shaman hallucinates slash severs a tether and stares into forever. He screams absurdity slash writes eternity into a scroll. He goes insane slash exchanges brain for soul and becomes whole. Drum rolls unfold uncontrolled. Let the tongue go, tumble into the one flow from Wan Wan Go. Nyan Bengay ragas go with trance to tango, zydeco, premiere beats and swing dance. We sing chants extrapolated from a master bass kick pulsing from the universal core. It's vast and ancient imagination.
Yes, indeedy. Want to say thank you and a deep bow of gratitude to Cactus, aka Agent 23, aka Secret Agent 23 Skidoo. What a absolutely incredible, enlightening conversation, and I sure love it when the podcast guest is ready to go and has so much to say in such articulate fashion. Man, this dude is brilliant. He's educating the children. Wu-Tang is for the children. And so is Cactus. And so, teach your children well, like the song goes. And my man took it to heart and started in his own house. And now he's going macro with it. So I was just blown away with everything Cactus brought to the table. But most potently, the education through hip-hop. And also the sort of cross-pollinating of classical and international instruments and timeless storytelling. I mean, dude, my man is killing the game in all the right ways. So shout out Cactus. Thank you for the time, for the energy, and for everything that you shared. And I'm going to finish up like we always do about this time with the Vibe Junkie Jam. And I'm going to go with my favorite shit, my favorite Cactus shit. Agent 23 and the Galactic Federation of Earth Dwellers. The record is self-fulfilling prophecy. We're here in Fiddlesticks right now with Adam Strange and Chichilli. But we're going to go with another Adam Strange collab, Dream State Theater. Between the beat and the production and the emceeing and the vibe and the energy and the time in my life when I heard it. Came out in 01, so I probably heard it shortly after that, back when they were, you know, kind of the late night ratchet rage scene post Phish, particularly in the Northeast, or really the whole East Coast, as you heard us talk about a little bit in the pod. So I'm going to throw it back. Dream State Theater, 2001, Self-Fulfilling Prophecy, Agent 23, and the Galactic Federation of Earth Dwellers. And with that, I'm going to say goodbye and Jah bless. And we'll see you next time. Yes, indeedy.
Is legitimate, got so much love I keep spilling it, asking party people to tell me if they feeling it, when I can't even feel my own hands. I'm hearing voices in the amps and I'm forgetting how to stand. This time it's personal, except I can't remember who I am. So welcome to the new me, current circumstance, cosmetically restructuring the surface of eternity, verbally work between the facts and the absurdity. City, different name, but everything looks the same. Bohemian quarter street performer for spare change. I'm next to Adam Strange.
That's me, I'm still thinking about my verse. Here comes a rich lady with a poodle and a Gucci purse. You drop the beat in that coffee cup, we'll crowd up disturbed. 12 bucks in the hat and a little bag of herb. You wanna keep it going?
Hell yeah, that dinner rush ain't even over. I'm trying to make enough for Ben and Jerry's and a mocha. And hopefully a Guinness if this business stays steady. Let's bust this out, look at those clouds, it's gonna rain heavy. Yo, you ready?
Yeah, watch me show these people what freestyle is. Fill the hat with money, jump around, acting tired. I just felt a drop, pack up, let's find a spot. How about that couch at that girl's house?
Probably not, her man is back again. We can't come crashing and looking all street.
There's some plywood, let's climb up on this bar and build a lean-to.
But won't that seep through?
I got a tarp, we'll make it heat-proof.
I feel you, let's do this shit and get to sleep, dude.
I'm laying on the rooftop,
tube socks stinking.
Below me Willie Nelson,
on the jukebox singing.
On the road again, I'ma spin this week
and finish drinking,
then off to dreamland.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking. I'm having visions. I don't remember slipping into sleep. Maybe I'm tripping off of the fumes emitting from my feet. I'm in a whole nother life. What an unusual night. No, this is not my car. This is not my beautiful wife. Who's this little tyke and why she keep calling me pop? And how's my name on this portfolio for all of these stocks? If this is a dream, Mr. Sandman gets the props. And if not, I hope these hallucinations don't stop. Cause now I'm on this fast stage freestyling in front of a crowd of thousands. And they're all smiling and shouting. Next to me's a bunch of MCs and a live band. We seem to know each other cause we play in this tight jam. My right hand's on a mic and in my left is a Sammy Smith. I take a sip and take a breath, then my mind is made up. I'm staying, I don't give a fuck. If this is a dream, then I ain't waking up.
I think I lit my joint and smoked at least half of it. I was planning out tomorrow, but my mind changed the subject. I woke up in a hotel clean with new clothes and some guys I never met that said they'd drive me to the show. On the way, they played me my new CD and we smoked weed, joking about the girls we're about to meet. Then all of a sudden, what the fuck? I'm getting yanked about my seat and I reappear in Costa Rica naked on the beach. I stayed for 3 weeks, caught a hell of a tan. Then all of a sudden, New York at the Chelsea Grand. I played the wetland, but just before we set the jam, I ended up down south in a black suit. Then BMW four-door
with the Outcast player.
I don't think I got a license, but I don't seem to be caring. Got the 12s in the back and the sunroof pop. Cruise by all the hippies at the coffee shop. I got a pocket full of cash and a bag of pot and a deep down desire that this dream don't stop.
Oh man, shit. Damn, crazy. I just had this crazy dream, man.
Oh no shit, yes. So did I, man. Like in Seattle and I was on the street spare changing.
Oh no shit, I was sleeping on the rooftop of my dream. That's crazy.
Yeah, that's it. You wanna get some breakfast?
Yeah. Should I drive or you wanna drive?